Okay, go for it.
Hi, my name is Contras and I'm from the Apple Farm in Tipperary.
And you're listening to The Sod Show.
Do you want to do that again or do you want to leave it like that? Fine. Very good.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Sod Show Garden Podcast.
I'm sitting up the back of a field. That's field isn't at home. I'm sorry. I should have a little bit more eloquent than that. But I'm surrounded by what you and I would know in farming terms as a shelter belt. I'm next to an area of wildflowers, and then I'm surrounded entirely by pretty much apples and some raspberries. Con, well, I've had you on. I think it might have been about 4 or 5 years ago.
That's right, yes. We were just talking about the farm in general, I suppose, and how we got to farm and so on at that time. So, yeah, that was good.
Have you listened back to it since?
I don't think I've... I listened to it at the time, but I don't think I've listened back to it since, no.
Okay, so for you listening at home, press pause on this one. Go back, or just stick into iTunes or your podcast provider, Contrast. T-R-A-A-S and Sod Show, and it'll come up for you, and then come back here and this one will play on. How is business, Con? We've had of 2018 probably one of the most challenging years for a guy who builds gardens anyway. We've had 2-3 months of sub-zero temperatures, and then we went to the entire extreme of essentially drought conditions.
Yeah, it's been a really unusual year, that's no doubt about it. We were lucky enough, I suppose, Storm Ophelia was last October, but we had most of our apples picked at that time. That would have been our biggest threat, probably more so than a long and cold winter and so on. But we survived that relatively unscathed. And then it went into that really long and extended winter with the late snows and so on. But luckily all our plants were still pretty much dormant at that stage, so that didn't do any harm. In fact, it suited some of the crops, because when they started growing, then it was full on fast growth. But then the drought came. Luckily we have water on a lot of our crops, so we were able to water 3/4 of the orchard and all of the strawberries and that kind of thing. So it's still very dry. This cooking apples, which we don't water, are a little bit smaller than they should be. But aside from that, I'd be very happy with the summer, to be fair, even though it's been exceptionally hard, especially on the farmers around here.
What's it like being, of a mindset? I know what it's like for me as an individual where of gardens, all landscaping essentially stalled on one hand. And then on the other hand, it was brilliant for hard landscaping, but not great at all if you were doing any sort of planting over the course of the year. So how anybody's turnover, inverted commas, would be up would be slightly baffling, unless they won the lottery. To be quite fair, we're both giggling at this one, but it has an effect, I think, when you turn around and say, honey, you're going to need to stall off on buying that new car this year, that thing, that holiday to the Bermuda Triangle. We're not doing it. How's that affected you?
Yeah, I suppose because we're just, we're selling the products of the plants. As long as we can keep the plants alive, it works for us. I fully understand what you're saying, though. Even, I planted a few garden plants, early in the summer, and I've just been watering them and watering them. I probably would have planted a lot more if the weather had been better, but when you just have to go out with three watering cans every evening just for the 10 plants that you've planted, you're not inclined to plant any more. So I understand fully why in these kind of conditions people may not be involved in, even in the simplest bits of landscaping, just buying a few plants and putting them in the garden and so on. It requires a lot of work.
Has it affected, and I say this in horticulture, always being a series of hindsights, I should have planted daffodil bulbs in October and therefore I would see them in flower in February, March, April. In that analogy into fruit production, has it affected you in that context?
Well, we got kind of lucky, I suppose. We did plant quite a lot of strawberries outside in the springtime this year, which we don't do every year. And I just did it because we had a bit of spare space, And if it had been a wet summer, like we might typically have, you know, those strawberries may not have been able to pick them all. I may have lost some to, you know, to just to general weather damage and that kind of thing. But with the really dry weather, it actually was kind of fortunate for us. So it's always like you say, it's hindsight is great. You know, if I'd known that what the summer was going to do like it did, I could have done even more of that, and it would have been great. But it's, yeah, you can't tell in advance what's going to happen, so you just take a guess and just do whatever you're kind of thinking about. But it is a gamble every time, one way or the other.
You've planted since I was last here anyway, and I think I've been, yeah, for those who are unaware, and again, I'll refer to that previous episode from 4 or 5 years ago. Nothing has changed since then, and I guess that was a little bit more about the man rather than the practice, if you'll allow me put it that way. But the biggest thing that I noticed was about an acre of wildflowers. Why, how do I say it, why bother your arse?
Yeah, I suppose what's been happening is that, of course, it's very much in the public mind now as well about pollinating insects and declines in their numbers and so on. And, you know, for a very long time here, we got our pollinators for free from nature, if you like. So there were just happened to be lots of pollinating insects living, probably not so much on our farm, but on farms where you would have, you know, weedy species, I suppose you might call them, or wildflowers or whatever, just growing in, you know, in the environment, and those, you know, those fed and provided habitat for pollinating insects, and we got those pollinators for free. I suppose with you know, with the change over the years from, you know, making hay to making silage, where the grass is cut earlier, when you know, you just don't get as much flowering species in grassland and so on. There is a lot of grassland around us here, but the numbers of pollinators were declining, possibly also because of, you know, chemicals that were being used, although in the last few years a number of those have been banned by the European Union, so that's hopeful for the future. Just in general, I suppose, things that nature was giving us for free we now can't take for granted anymore, so we have to make an effort to provide for nature, to provide for us, I suppose you might say.
But there's an argument, and I mean, let me sidetrack slightly here again, as invariably I do, but one of the things I remember from reading the Principles of Horticulture, you might remember that, a very old school book, not yeah, of I approval there yet. Yeah, so the Principles of Horticulture essentially was day one Bible, pain in the backside, Pythagoras' theorem, learn it off by heart, essentially. But it provided a very good foundation for understanding everything else that came across the way. And once you got those equations essentially into your head, or that logic or that theory or that practice into your brain, everything for me just seemed to flow and follow. And one of them that I remember was, you know, 1% loss in light equals 1% loss in production for glasshouses, which makes perfect sense. If you block out 100% of light, for those of you listening at home, you get zero production. Yeah, yeah. So if it gets a bit dirty, so essentially clean your glasshouses. That's the basics of it. But in your case, you could have put production or return or apples cropped, you could have put that down to season and snow, and essentially if you take 2010-11, the winter of discontent, as I refer to it, where we'd minus 18 Celsius on Christmas Day, you could have put your reduction of apples down to that and not to pollinators.
It's a difficult one to quantify, really. It's really just, I suppose you'd say, it's more qualitative observation rather than any quantitative, you know, counting of things. So, you know, you're looking at what's out there when you're in the orchard or in your field, and if you don't see an awful lot of queen bumblebees, you know, arriving in, you know, at the time, normally they would come out around the time when the plums are in flower with us here, you're kind of saying, well, why is there less queen bumblebees this year? And, you know, if that happens for a number of years, you're then starting to really scratch your head, because fine, if it happens for 1 year, it might be the cold winter or it might be something else. But if it's continuing for a while, you're beginning to say, is there something deeper apart from just the unusual weather or whatever affecting it? So I suppose, you know, it's a matter of kind of looking at what other people maybe think as well and saying, okay, well, you know, are they possibly right if they're saying that it might be certain insecticides that are being used, or it might be loss of habitat or whatever. So if, you know, it's a certain amount, if it feels right, you know, maybe that's a cause. So in a way, this is a bit of an experiment. So we're providing habitat and we're providing food source for those pollinators here. I am hoping that we'll see more, you know, more queens surviving the winter as a consequence, and more of them there next year. A few years ago, we had a similar area on the other side of the farm, and it did seem to make a difference. But again, that's anecdotal. It's not proof.
You had sorry, there's a bee right beside my ear. Funnily enough, as we speak, it you do. Okay, so I've got a mild stumbling block because essentially I'm on holidays, but invariably I just can't help myself. And so all I've done is visit gardens this weekend, and I'm camping in an orchard again. But I wouldn't stop for the world. But walking through your orchards, looking at the pruning and seeing how it was, just observing, you'd red boxes tied into some of the trees. What were they? And explain that to me like, yeah, I'm a 2-year-old.
I suppose, obviously, we've been talking about pollinators, but that doesn't, you know, cover the whole ecology, I suppose, of what's in the orchard, if you know what I mean. So I suppose years ago, the orchard was basically something that you would try to crop, and if there was something in there you didn't want, you would spray it to get rid of it. And it didn't matter what else you accidentally killed, you just were looking at that one small part of the overall picture, if you know what I mean. I suppose the understanding of the complexity has changed a lot, and the management has changed as a consequence. So nowadays we understand that it's beneficial to leave an awful lot of things in the orchard. So if you do see something that you don't want there, you don't go and spray it. You try and figure out how you can manage it. And that might mean, in the case of those red traps that you're talking about, those are traps which just count the numbers of particular moths. So those traps have the scent of a female moth in them. They've got a bit of glue in the bottom. The male moths smell that lure. They come in and land on the traps, and you can count them. And if you can count them, you have an idea, first of all, of, you know, when they're breeding, how many are there. And that gives you an indication then as to whether you need to take some action or not, because you might not need to take any action, or you might be able to put out more traps and just, you know, catch enough males that they can't mate. Those are the kind of potential solutions to one particular pest that might be there that won't affect the ecology of the other things that are living there, because, of course, the orchard is full of lots of beneficial things as well as potentially harmful things. So it's about management of those things. Right now, if you went and picked a few apples, there's a few nearly ripe, you'll find lots of earwigs in there. And the earwigs are there because they're feeding on the larvae of aphids. And that's a really, really effective control. We haven't sprayed for aphids in probably 25 years or so. Earwigs can be a little bit of a pest, all right, when you get them into your pack house or whatever, but they're fantastic to have outside in the orchard.
I'll go back to the principles of horticulture, and it's something that came up in conversation a few weeks ago, speaking with Maddie Harland, a really good double episode, actually. She's the editor and co-founder of Permaculture Magazine. I can't recommend that episode highly enough. I was talking to her about good husbandry, a word I don't hear too much anymore. And when I was going through college, as we were chatting before we came on air, those old 1920s, 1930s books that I used to buy, no colour photography, no black and white photography, they were all just illustrations. A lot of the things they, on one hand, they got wrong, but what they spoke in depth of was good husbandry, or essentially keeping the place spick and span, giving it a good tidy up once a year, but not eradicating absolutely everything. You seem to, by all accounts, have a pretty good shop. Your apple trees are, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but they seem to be about 2.5 approximate meters apart. You're not of approval there, from pruning and then growing out. They're all within the same width, within the same height. The grass is kept clipped in between. There's very little foliage on the ground or dead and decaying material. All of those basics, you seem to follow them as if it's still Peter going through horticultural college reading those old black and white books. How far off the mark am I on that, and how important is that basic good husbandry?
Some parts of that are really important, as you say. The bits like pruning out, let's say, sick branches, those kind of things are quite labour intensive, obviously. So in modern agriculture, modern horticulture, you know, with it's maybe not practiced as much as it might have been 50 years ago, you know, when labour was plentiful and probably cheaper. But those are really important practices. I suppose that the ones that I still do here that you mentioned, that may change in the future would be keeping the ground quite bare, for instance, under the trees, which it is at the moment, but that's partly because of the very dry season. So we haven't been concentrating as much on removing weeds, shall we say, in, or as they might be called, in the orchards as we used to. And that's a kind of a difficult mind shift to make for somebody like me who's been a long time, you know, eradicating weeds and so on. So yeah, it's a matter of being a little bit less fussy or precise in some things, and maybe adjusting our understanding of what, you know, of what competes with the tree and what in the long run is actually benefiting the tree. And obviously that, you know, would be different in a crop of onions or different in another crop, as to what you can accept as, you know, as in there, if in terms of competing vegetation or whatever. But the trees are fairly resilient to competing vegetation, as I can see in some other farms. So it's a matter really again of trying to learn a little bit more, maybe than I knew before. But of course, you know, when you're talking about those books, even going back nearly 100 years at this stage, you know, when people were controlling the weeds in orchards and the likes, it wasn't by and large with organic chemicals like now either. And there's, you know, I speak to guys who, let's say, who are nurserymen in the Netherlands. They, you know, there's a lot of trees produced, and they've pretty much stopped using herbicides in the nurseries, because although it's killing the weeds, it also has a detrimental effect on the trees. It reduces their growth by maybe 10%, and they only noticed that when they started growing trees for organic fruit farms, and when they stopped using the herbicides, because they couldn't use the herbicides in those situations, they actually found that the trees in their nurseries grew better. So now all the conventional nurseries aren't using herbicides in their nurseries anymore, because they're getting an extra 10% or so growth in the trees in a year. So it's amazing the things that are, you know, that are found out kind of, you could say, almost by accident sometimes. Of course, if it was full of weeds, then the trees would grow even less. So you've got to manage the weeds in that particular example. But it's not necessarily about elimination.
How many trees have you got in the orchard at this moment in time?
There's about 40,000 fruit trees altogether, mostly apple trees and some plums as well. Yeah, we'll see if we add some more. I haven't got much space left to add some more, but I may have to take some away to add some more, if you know what I mean. It's a long time since we've replanted orchard. We put in a new orchard in 2013. That was the last new one that went in, but I didn't take away any old trees. Our oldest trees are from 1982. So if I do want to plant some more, I might have to take away some of the older ones.
Does the production, and I gather it will, a bit like roses, where they need to be replaced every 10 to 15 years. You're talking a 35-year-old fruit tree sitting there, let's be honest, like a bit of a granny, but I'd find it quite hard as an individual to take that tree away on one hand. On the other hand, you've got a business to run, and you can see a decline in, well, we only got 7 ton off of that part or that orchard or that part of the orchard that year. It was 10 5 years ago, it was 12 15 years before that. It's time to say goodbye and make a call on it. Do you make that call, and is it a no-brainer, or how does that work with you?
Yeah, there certainly is a bit of sentimentality involved. I suppose where we're sitting now in this, beside the wildflowers, this was an orchard that my father originally planted in 1968. So that was a difficult one for me to take out. Luckily, he was still alive at the time, and he was very much in favour of taking it out. There were quite a lot of sick trees in it. So, you know, that makes it easier if, you know, if nature is pushing you in the direction to take it out already. It's an easier choice to make. If I've got trees that are 35 years old and they're still healthy and they're still producing good crops, it's a more difficult decision to make. But usually that decision is made by the consumer, funnily enough, because if the consumer, if their preference in apples changes from one variety to another, let's say I have some Cox's Orange Pippin there and less people are looking for Cox's Orange Pippin than they used to be, and they're looking for more of a different apple, then you have to keep them happy ultimately. So that means the Cox's Orange Pippin will have to go, and they'll have to be replaced with whatever the new, you know, favorite thing is.
What was it? Wasn't it Granny Smith when I was growing up? Granny Smith and a cheese single inside two slices of bread multiplied by eight children for me. I don't know what it was for you.
It was golden delicious here because that's what we grew. I had a good trade going in school though because I used to bring in a few apples every day, and there was a guy in the class who loved apples, and his parents had a shop, so he used to bring me up an ice cream at lunchtime for a couple of apples. So that was a...
Do you prune? And this has baffled me because... Not baffled me, but it's only when you say 40,000 trees. I've got about 35 fruit trees at home. They serve a primary function as a hedge, and their secondary function is to produce fruit. I say hedge by definition, not by pruning them every single year. I still do. Are there any diseased or dead branches on it, or damaged branches? Yes, okay. Where they were wounded, you might have used a bit of Pansil T, the old blue paint on it. And once they're removed, then it's whether they're cooking or whether they're for eating, you then do the triangle or you do the hand-shaped cup pruning. Yeah, it hasn't changed a bit. Do you still do all of them by hand?
Yeah, they're still all pruned by hand. I suppose I used to prune, you know, a handy bit, I suppose. You know, maybe you could say 3 or 4 hours a day in the winter time. What's happened, I suppose, is the farm has gotten bigger. I have less and less time to be outside in the field. So we have probably one staff member here who's been pruning orchards for more than 20 years, and a few guys have been probably pruning them for around 10 years or so. So it's the most, I suppose, experienced guy who we have a chat with every year as to what we're going to do with the different varieties, and he kind of sets everyone off. We would have probably 3 or 4 people pruning almost every day during the winter, from when the apple harvest is finished, when the first leaves fall off, which is early November, and they continue right through till March. So there's quite a lot of work in that pruning. All right, it takes quite a while, but it's not bad work. You know, obviously your feet can get cold if the weather is cold or whatever, so make sure you got good ski socks on and good boots on. But it's kind of interesting enough. It keeps your brain ticking over because you're continuously making decisions as to, you know, what branch you're going to take, which one you're going to leave. And, you know, the guys will have headphones in, they'll be listening away to probably your Sideshow or whoever. I'll be telling them to do that anyway. So, you know, or the music or whatever. So it's not, if you like being outside, it's actually not bad work. Sometimes the weather can be a bit rough, so you need the right gear, but yeah.
I always found it quite therapeutic, and it's not like you're picking weeds out of, you know, 40,000 tree litre pots in the nursery. And even at that, what you observe as a student, if you're listening to this, is hugely important. And I know some people will go in and say, well, all I did was weeded pots for, you know, 3 weeks solid. And I'm saying, well, how many pots per hour, how much space per square metre did those 3 litre pots take up, how many plants have you got? And they can't give me the answers, and I'm saying you're looking at it wrong. But in the pruning of apple trees, there is a bit of an art to it, but it's also, once you say master that art, is that a correct way to put it?
Yes, I think so. Years ago when you were using hand secateurs, you would get a very sore hand for the first few weeks, and after 3 or 4 hours you would rather not be pruning for the afternoon if you'd done a morning or whatever. But these days the secateurs are electronic, so they have a little motor in them, so you don't have to really stretch your hand that badly. Obviously the small branches you may cut with hand secateurs, and there are little electronic chainsaws as well, very, very small chainsaws that can be used to cut out slightly bigger branches and so on. So the equipment makes the work, I suppose, a little bit less fatiguing on the hands, and you still have to have your head engaged in the job. So it definitely is a therapeutic type of work, there's no question about it.
What's the future? I'll backtrack that question. Folks, you're the son of a... What was John Lennon's quote? I'm the son of a sailor man's son. But in your case, you're the son of an apple farmer's son with a son on the way who is going to get up and do a little bit of strawberry picking for you, etc., etc., as it should be, says you. What's the future, bearing in mind what you have seen, what your dad has seen, and going forward 20 years?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I spent a couple of weeks in New Zealand earlier this year at an International Fruit Tree Association meeting, and there was a lot of people from the United States there, and they're very much, you know, some of those growers are really big guys. They, you know, they would have probably farms 10 times, 20 times the size of what we have here, and they're asking those questions in a very serious way, and they're starting to think about robotics for harvesting fruit. And indeed, we saw some robots for harvesting kiwis and that when we were over there. They're not complex enough for harvesting apples yet. But it's a really interesting question, you know, when the processing power of computers and the ability of cameras to detect slight differences in color between apples that, you know, are just slightly underripe, exactly ripe for picking, overripe, and so on, which you know is actually something like that is quite difficult if you're, you know, if you're picking. Again, it's something that we're naturally good at because we're good at picking up those slight color tones and so on, and once somebody gets used to what they're supposed to be picking, it's easy to do, but it's very hard to, it has been to this point very hard to get a machine to do it, because the amount of understanding that's involved is much more than you might initially think. But they're starting to think about that kind of thing now. I suppose if that happens, you know, there's no theoretical limit on the largest size you can have a fruit farm anymore, because if you're going to have robots to pick them and so on, there's no reason why you wouldn't have 5,000 acres instead of 1,000 acres, or 10,000 acres instead of 5,000 acres, or what have you. So those are interesting things. I suppose there is also, I hope anyway, if, you know, our scale by international standards is quite small, even though by Irish standards it's kind of typical, the farm size we have here. You know, if there are customers interested in buying fruit from, you know, family-owned enterprises like we have here, then we have a future for a long time been doing other things. So, you know, obviously there's strawberries and raspberries and plums and cherries that lead into the apple season, and that goes through the winter into the following year when the soft fruits start again, and the juices and cider and that kind of thing. You'll find a lot of the, you know, the fruit growers have diversified, you know, in ways like that, or doing something else to, you know, to make their businesses, I suppose, more relevant to consumers, rather than just producing fruit that's going to go into a supply chain that'll arrive in a supermarket, and where there's very little connection between the grower and the consumer anymore. That's a very efficient, I suppose, process for very large growers, but probably not very financially sustainable for smaller scale like we have here in Ireland. So that's a big question. I don't know where the future is going to go. That luckily, in a way, that'll be if any of my kids decide to do something with this farm whenever they want to, they're welcome to try it. If they don't, I'll just keep doing it myself until I retire or fall down or something like that. Yeah, that's the hardest question of all, to see what's going to happen in the future. It really is. I suppose there are some things that we know for sure, that the climate is changing, that we're going to get more unusual weather like that we have been. You know, that a summer like this is probably twice as likely as it was 30 or 40 years ago. That a winter like last winter is also twice as likely as it was. So those kind of things, we need to, I suppose, if we're going to be in fruit, we need to be ready for, you know, for more unusual events, and probably lots more usual events. But beyond that, it's very hard to say, really.
We were talking a couple of days ago, and I was saying my 8-year-old daughter was trying to explain in school what Daddy did for a living. And I think she said that I make gardens, and they said, oh, he's a gardener. And I think she said, no, he's landscaping. And they said, oh, he's a gardener. And she went, no. And I think she was trying to explain that, because that, it's a long story, but essentially I hadn't worked on a Monday and a Tuesday because I was heading off to France to do a project over there. And I said, just tell him your daddy has a very different job. Couldn't wrap her head around how to say it in her 8-year-old language. You do something similar but entirely different, from the cider making to the apple making to essentially fruit production. I mean, it's unbelievable how much you do essentially from one, let's say, base ingredient. Or
well, I suppose we did encounter that, you know, when my kids were a bit younger. Mine are older than yours. I've got a daughter, Ella, same as yourself. When they can see what's happening, it's easier to explain. You can't bring them to a site and show them, you know, the landscaping process happening. I suppose if you're trying to explain something in 20 seconds, it is very difficult to explain something rather complex in such a short time. So I generally kind of just say who I am and give a list of the products I produce, if you know what I mean. But that it's an inadequate response, really.
If you get a chance and you're in Tipperary, you might have seen some of the notes I put out on Twitter. It's a fantastic place to come, fantastic place to camp. Got a personal place in my heart, but that's part because I'm surrounded by trees, and I get to go into pure escapism away from probably what I should be doing, which is relaxing, but I don't do that terribly well. Anyway, contrast, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's great to have you here.
If you listen at home, at Sudshow on Twitter, facebook.com/Sudshow, Sudshow.com. Have a great weekend. Take care. Bye.